This is a production of Cornell University.
Well, Jeff, thanks very much for the segue. I appreciate it with respect to critical infrastructure. And also, I guess, Lance Davis has provided a segue because he's now doing a full-scale experiment on transportation sustainability. As you can see by the slides, I'm going to talk about sustainability from the trauma ward or from the recovery ward, if you want. I'm going to talk about critical infrastructure with respect to hazards. And as part of sustainability, recognizing that the first step of sustainability may actually be survivability, how we get from one critical event to the next. And that also will bring up the issue of resilience, another term we hear in the engineering context quite frequently these days, but probably the first step in sustainability. That is, how are we able to recover from the shocks and the demands that affect our infrastructure and systems? So the topics I'm going to cover today will involve critical infrastructure, the Tohoku earthquake and Canterbury earthquake sequence, hurricanes, New York City and New Orleans, and then what I would like to refer to as the new normal. Let's start with critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure is an evolving concept. If you have a hard time defining it, it's because it changes with respect to time. It's a moving target. In the 1980s, we emphasized public sector, highways, bridges, airports, etc. After 9/11 and the attack on our critical infrastructure, it was expanded by the Department of Homeland Security to 17 sectors in the U.S. National Infrastructure Plan. And so if you were to go to that plan, you would see these different sectors. And although this allows for additional flexibility in dealing with infrastructure, you will see that just dealing with the banking and finance sector is probably enough on our plate at one time. So what we've managed to do in terms of protecting critical infrastructure is that we've added complexity to a system that is already quite complex. This is what you would do if you wanted to protect things. If you wanted to study, there are some suggestions about critical infrastructure. I'm having to deal with lifeline systems that are proposed by the American Society of Civil Engineers, which are geographically distributed critical infrastructure and would be represented by these six types of systems that you see before you in the slide. There are some factors or features of critical infrastructure we all need to recognize. One of them is geometric or geographical proximity. We have urban congestion. This is a picture of Wall Street and William Street from the early 1920s. And it illustrates two things about critical infrastructure. Number one, this is our national treasure. It provides us with the services and resources that we need for modern communities. And like every treasure, we bury it. So unless it's exposed to be viewed like this, we don't even know where it is many times, let alone know what its condition is. The other aspect is that if you look at one of these cast iron water mains and imagine them breaking, they will rapidly fail the adjacent piece of infrastructure, be that a telecommunications cable or electric power, and therefore you have truly a cascading event, not when you cascade within an electrical system, but when you cascade from one system to another system. And New York City has been a great testbed for that. There are many instances where there have been multiple failures originating from a single water main failure. If you were wondering what it looks like today, that picture was taken 5 years ago in about the same location. The next aspect of critical infrastructure is interoperability. This is a slide that's been taken from a presentation prepared by Sandia Labs. If we look at electric power and natural gas, they don't exist independently. There's a reciprocity there, where one provides power for natural gas and fuel for the generators. There are other reciprocities between water, the electric natural gas systems, oil, and then transportation and financial markets. So not only are we affected by congestion, but we are affected by interoperability. And if one system goes out, it affects another system. And then the final aspect of infrastructure or characteristic, which is very important, is the institutional interdependencies. If we look at these different geographically distributed infrastructure systems, one of the things we recognize institutionally is that infrastructure is balkanized. And if I can put the map of Yugoslavia behind it like that, we are talking about entities that have entirely different institutional cultures, corporate cultures, and so forth. And solving the infrastructure and sustainability problem requires us to understand something about the sociology, politics, and economics that goes on among these different factors. So the human element and institution elements are quite strong here. Okay, so let's take a look at the Tohoku and Canterbury earthquake sequence because they had a very important impact on how things are happening in the world today. The Tohoku earthquake was a 9-magnitude earthquake. It was the largest earthquake, the fourth largest measured. It shifted the axis of the Earth from 10 to 25 centimeters. That doesn't sound like much given the size of the Earth, but the next flight to Mars has to take this into account to put the rover where it needs to land it. It was 1,000 times more powerful than the 1995 Kobe earthquake, and when I went to Kobe in 95 several times after that earthquake, 1,000 times more power is really remarkable, and that it was 600 million times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. I'm having trouble advancing these slides. Okay, there was about 16,000 deaths, about 3,000 people are still missing, 1,200 buildings destroyed, about $235 billion in direct losses as estimated by the World Bank, and approximately $620 billion estimated in a recent article by The Economist, in The Economist, for nuclear contamination and decommissioning. The tsunami was the main part of this earthquake. Inundation of about 561 square kilometers of the eastern side of Honshu Island. Tsunami heights anywhere from 3 to 7.3 meters until you had run-up. 50 kilometers of run-up on the Kitakami River and destruction of many seawalls. This is a picture of some of the inundation that we can see in the Sendai Plain. If we look at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, this was really the epicenter, if you want, in terms of infrastructure impact. The issue was that the tsunami came on shore. It overwhelmed the protection structures that were on the seaside of the power plant. And if you look at this particular cross-section through the plant, the tsunami here was approximately 15 meters high. It was well over the top of the 5.7 meter seawalls, which were supposed to protect the plant. And of course, there was a 46 meter high splash associated with this, which inundated the diesel generators, also tossed around fuel canisters and so on and so forth, and then also destroyed the exchange on the water side in terms of heat. So even if there was energy here, the destruction of the conveyance structures that were circulating heat on this power plant was quite severe and would have had a strong impact. If we take a look at the kind of boiling water reactors that we had on this plant, we have a reaction pressure vessel, which is the central part of this in which the control rods and the nuclear fuel exchanges heat with circulating water, and of course that is condensed and exchanged with the seawater. That is contained in a primary containment vessel, and these things are really big structures. So you have 200 millimeter thick, that's 8-inch thick steel plate associated with the primary reaction vessel and the primary containment vessel, 2-inch thick steel. What actually happens is that when the destruction of the diesel generators occurred, there was no longer the ability to circulate water. As a consequence, the fuel in the fuel rods increased the heat to about 1,000, about 1,200 degrees centigrade. At that level, the zirconium cladding on those fuel rods begins to decompose, and as it decomposes, it generates hydrogen. Those pressure, as the fuel rods decompose, the nuclear fuel drops to the bottom of the reaction pressure vessel. It burned through there, got into the primary containment vessel, and then at least in Unit 1, burned through the primary containment vessel into the concrete floor of the reaction buildings. Of course, this hydrogen, which builds up at the same time, of course, is explosive, and that created the explosions that we saw on television and at some of the reaction buildings. So if we take a look at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, and I'm going to back up just a minute, we had electric power loss before any tsunami because of all of the substations being affected by swinging wires and shorting and so forth and tripping out those substations. The tsunami flooded all diesel generators except one air-cooled diesel generator, which was affecting reactor units 5 and 6 and actually was able and was responsible for keeping them in shape. And then the seawater cooling system was destroyed, as you can see in this picture. It was the first part to be hit by the tsunami wave. We had partial meltdowns in units 1, 2, and 3 in the primary reaction pressure vessels and primary containment vessels. There was loss of cooling in unit 4 to the spent fuel pool, and that was gave great concern for a while. And then there were hydrogen explosions in all 4 units. For a while, it was thought that that some of the problems in the spent fuel pool was responsible for the explosion in reactor number 4, but now it's recognized that migrating gas from unit number 3 caused that explosion. There has been an independent panel, it's called the Hatamura panel, that has investigated this particular event. And they itemized a lot of issues associated with the response. One of these was the loss of off-site emergency center. They're supposed to have an emergency center at all of these nuclear power plants. There was one established 5 kilometers from the Fukushima plant. However, that particular emergency center did not have transportation, did not have water, did not have fuel, and also had air filters that were not appropriate for filtering out radiation, and it was abandoned within 1 day. There was a failure to delegate authority at the local level, but especially even within the Prime Minister's office. On the 4th floor of the Prime Minister's office, there was an emergency group of prime ministers and also ministers that were involved in the government that was convened. On the bottom floor, there were the managers of the major utilities that were there to give advice to the Prime Minister's office, and there was very poor communication with the Prime Minister's office, often setting certain rules that were not necessarily cleared with the people on the bottom floor. There were evacuation mistakes. People were evacuated from areas with less radioactivity to more radioactivity on more than one occasion. Eventually, as you may well know, there was about 20-kilometer radius around the plant that was eventually abandoned. In addition, it was known that in 1869, there was a Sanrico earthquake and tsunami that academic community had done excavations of a thin sand layer and dated that radiocarbon and then could then relate it to the history of the area, and showed at that time that there was an earthquake to generate that kind of tsunami inundation of at least 8.4 magnitude. It's now recognized that that deposit didn't represent the full run-up of the water, and then when you adjust for the full run-up, people recognize that this particular earthquake and tsunami was probably on the order of about 8.7 or 8.8, or roughly equivalent to the one we have here. So when you're working with nuclear power, you're supposed to be dealing at least in a 1 in 10,000 event. Clearly, our recurrence interval here is on the order of about 1,000 years, and that represents an order of magnitude difference. Okay, we're going to try to get the slide to go forward. So what do we find? Japan had imports 84% of its energy. The nuclear reactors supply about 30% of electricity as of 2009. Japan had planned to increase to 40% by 2017, and nuclear power was part of its CO2 reduction strategy. As of May 5th, just a few days ago, none of the 54 reactors which were operating prior to the Tohoku earthquake are currently operating, so that's zero capacity. This has gone global. Germany is going to close out its nuclear power in 2010. That produced 22.4% of electricity in Germany. Switzerland, not known for tsunamis, has also decided to terminate its nuclear power. It generated 40% of electricity in 2008, and of course there was an Italian referendum which reaffirmed the opposition in that country to nuclear power. So there are some significant sustainability, especially with energy issues associated with this one event. Let's go to New Zealand. Often New Zealand gets overlooked in this process because of the sheer magnitude of Tohoku. If Tohoku was a sledgehammer, New Zealand was a hypodermic needle. It says that you don't have to have a lot of energy, you just have to be in the wrong place when that energy gets released. It was subjected to a sequence of earthquakes, the first of them on the 4th of September 2010, magnitude 7.1, 6.2 magnitude on the 22nd of February, by far the most destructive event, a magnitude 6 on the 13th of June 2011, and a magnitude 6 for a Christmas present on the 23rd of December 2011. These successive earthquakes have literally devastated Christchurch. I lived in Christchurch in 1999. The Central Business District was destroyed by the 22nd February event. Is a tragedy to see it. Over 190 deaths, but probably more. There's a coroner's report now to determine indirect related deaths. The Central Business District destroyed. Over 1,000 buildings in the Central Business District have been demolished. 20,000 residences is destroyed or damaged heavily, and another 100,000 which needs serious repair. And what's probably most interesting, about $25 billion direct losses, or 20% of the GDP of New Zealand. One way to normalize an effect of a natural disaster is to look at it as your ability to produce going forward. That's more than the 10% associated with Tohoku for Japan, so quite significant. And massive liquefaction and infrastructure damage. If we look at some of the strong ground motion from this event, I'm going to look at four records here. The two at CHHSC and CCC are in the Central Business District of Christchurch, and the other one is in the Heathcote Valley. If we look at the strong motion records in terms, I'm going to go back because this is skipping. We have spectral accelerations, and what I'm going to point out here, the black line is the design level. The red line was the 2010 4th of September earthquake. New Zealand was known as the resilient nation then because they had designed exactly for the worst earthquake that they had experienced to that point. And then they got a 6.2 magnitude. We almost never think of that as causing this kind of damage. And you'll notice that this is a log scale, so that blue line is plotting well above the black line. They designed for a 1 in 500 year recurrence interval for buildings. This was a 1 in 5,000 year event. If we look at the additional records that are available for the Heathcote Valley, I'll just point out very quickly, relative to that black line, the September or the February 22nd event, which are the blue lines, are 1 in 10,000 year events in terms of shaking. So seriously high motions from very small magnitudes. About 70 to 80% of Christchurch liquefied. This is a map of the areas of liquefaction provided by Professor Kubanowski at the University of Canterbury. Strong ground motion records. We're going the wrong direction here. We're going to go back, and we're going to look at this location here, Bexley, which is on the eastern side of Christchurch. This is what Bexley looked like from the ground and from the air. The road systems had literally turned into canals, and the reason that the canals were there is not just that water was emanating from these sand boils and liquefaction, but they were breaking pipelines, water supply pipelines, which were also creating water, and the artesian conditions in Christchurch are the reason that they get their water. The artesian head in Bexley is on the order of about 6 meters to 7 meters, and so these wells broke and they were releasing about 500 cubic meters of water per hour. If that wasn't enough, the land subsides after it liquefies, and Bexley has subsided about 2 meters. It is now entirely abandoned, as are many, many communities along the Avon River, which feeds into the Bexley area and then into the estuary. Interestingly enough, one of the most important systems for Christchurch is its wastewater system. One thinks about being able to get rid of waste as an elemental aspect. And as Sherlock Holmes says in this case, my dear Watson, it's elementary. You have a situation here where there were over 2,000 plus breaks in the wastewater wastewater collection and distribution system. These are superimposed and shown to you on GIS here. There was tremendous damage and an inability because of these pipes breaking up every time there was a break. Sand would wash into those pipes, and then the sand would wash into the Bromley treatment plant, which was the only treatment plant for Christchurch. And as a consequence of that, the primary settlement tanks were filled with sediment, and therefore the bottom scrapers broke down. The clarifiers were settling in liquefiable soil, so you couldn't get secondary treatment. There still is no secondary treatment on this plant. They are sending the water into the lagoons with only primary and partial secondary treatment. The lagoons have levees in them, and those all shifted around, and so the chemistry and the biology has not been fixed yet, and there is a danger still of losing the wastewater facilities and treatment system in Christchurch. Okay, finally, insurance. New Zealand is now non-insurable. They used to have an earthquake commission, which provided insurance to everybody in New Zealand. During the Darfil event, the first of the earthquakes, there was a $1.5 billion was paid out from the earthquake insurance fund. Then they went to reinsurance companies for the next $2.5 billion, and then they went back to the reinsurance fund. Then that happened again when they got to the 22nd February, and eventually, after losing $5 billion, the reinsurance industry withdrew all support from New Zealand. They are uninsurable. Insurance is a market. There is no there's a buyer, but there certainly are no sellers here. And there were also insurance, other insurance that was lost in New Zealand. Try to get this thing to move forward. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about hurricanes in New Orleans. If we look at New Orleans, it's part of a 25,000 kilometer Mississippi deltaic plain. If we look at New Orleans here, it's the Mississippi River is running east-west. On the north side, we have Lake Pontchartrain, and on the south side, we have the Mississippi River. So New Orleans is between a rock and a hard place, the sea being the rock and the hard place being the river. This is now a cross-section through New Orleans, and I call this the Super Bowl of Sustainability. Anybody who lives in New Orleans lives about 2 to 3 meters at all time between one of the two different water levels on the Mississippi or on Lake Pontchartrain, and considerably more during flood stages. In addition, the land is subsiding there because of withdrawal of fluids, because of weights from the new levee system that they're building, from also organics oxidizing. So you have a very difficult condition of sustainability in New Orleans, and certainly a poster child for New Orleans. If we look at Hurricane Katrina, it was the greatest U.S. disaster, 2,000 dead and missing, over $100 billion of losses. About 80% of New Orleans was flooded, took 53 days to dewater, and there were substantial impacts from Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf offshore infrastructure and energy delivery systems. There were about 157 pipelines with all the offshore oil platforms that were destroyed. There was a complete failure of the hurricane protection system in New Orleans. And they got the hurricane hazard wrong. There was poor maintenance. There was all sorts of problems with respect to running the system. Hurricane Katrina changed our concept for critical infrastructure. After September 11, the mantra was the protection of critical infrastructure in terms of the Department of Homeland Security. After Hurricane Katrina, you couldn't say that because it was already protected by the government through the Corps of Engineers, and it was a total loss of the system. So therefore, the mantra has become resilient communities, and the term resilience is still being explored. If we look what it takes, what happens in New Orleans, the Mississippi River drains 41% of the U.S. during flood stages in the 20th century. The gauging station just north of New Orleans measured 65 kilotons of water per second. That's over a billion gallons of water per minute, and a billion gallons of water is the water supply of New York on a given day. So that's a lot of water that has to be managed, to put that into perspective. As we know, it's not just water that maintains the delta. There's sediment that comes down there, about 200 million tons, metric tons of sediment per year. That's enough to create 100 square kilometers of new land, anywhere between 1 to 2 meters deep, depending upon the void ratio you assume for the deposition. And without that sediment, you don't have the restorative capabilities of keeping the delta in dynamic equilibrium with the storms on the Gulf. So if we try to move this forward, if it wasn't also for the river and the sediment, we have a number of major storms that we had to contend with in 2005. 28 major storms, 15 hurricanes, over $120 billion at the time of direct damage. In fact, we had so many storms, we ran out of the English alphabet and had to use the Greek alphabet. I kind of look at that as a kind of a Greek bailout, so to speak. So we end up with communities and infrastructure which turn to the government and the Corps of Engineers to protect them from the river. The policy on the Mississippi for the first 100 years of flood protection was to build longer and more complete hurricane protection systems and levee systems, cutting off distributaries and so forth. So we lost wetlands, which then affects storm surge, which then affects communities. The solution to this problem is an optimization place in which neither of the river nor the storm surge in the Gulf get maximized, and it's a work in progress and one of the significant issues facing us in terms of sustainability. If that's not all, we have hurricane threats in New York City. Hurricane Irene, which hit New York City on the 28th of August in 2011, killed 56 people, about $10 to $15 billion of direct losses. Record flooding, New York City evacuation, shutting down the entire mass transportation system, and it was a near miss. If we look at some work that's been done by a professor now she's currently at MIT, and she will be joining Princeton, excuse me, I couldn't think of Princeton. She's done some simulations, and I'm showing these. Her name is Ning Lin, and I'm showing you some of these simulations to see the hydrograph for the battery that was affected by Hurricane Irene. You can see that the hurricane surge came in just as high tide, and high tide it puts about 0.5 meters of water on the surface there, and there was about 1.2 to 1.5 meters of water that came in with respect to Hurricane Irene, and that was just enough to go across the seawalls in the Manhattan area. And if we take a look at some of the work that Ning Lin has done, she's done some simulations of hurricane tracks, over 5,000, to create some statistics. And what you see over here is a generalized Pareto distribution capturing some of the distribution. But if you want to really look at these tails, this kind of simulation is very valuable. And you'll see that there is one lone event sitting out there about 5 meters. There are many of the other events are around 3 meters or so, which means it's eminently protectable at 3 meters. However, there is that one lone event, and then we try to adjust the tails of probabilities. That, I think, sometimes gives us some false security in terms of the mathematics, recognizing that we still have to deal with punctuated events. Okay, one of the things that we have, of course, and I'll go back to that slide, let's try to get that going. Not only in hurricanes which rotate in a counterclockwise direction as they come onto the shore in the United States, would create a surge going up the Battery of New York, they also can come in from the back end through Long Island, and that acts as a kind of a large plunger system here. So we really haven't explored this event where it would push water up into the Hell's Gate area of New York. We all know the East River is not a river, it's just a continuation of the ocean around Manhattan. And so this is the New York City hurricane flood zones. Notice that if we're looking at Zone A, Zone B, Zone Z, Zone B, which is the orange, is showing it for Category 2 or higher hurricanes. The yellow is showing for Category 3. Imagine that being inundating, what it would do for the mass transportation system in New York. I put New York City Hospital on there in East River because as Hurricane Irene came in, they had to abandon that entire hospital because they had all their generators in the basement. Sounds familiar. And then, of course, if we put the New York City Tech campus in place there. There it is in Roosevelt Island. There are a number of significant issues here associated with effects in New York. So this all brings us to the new normal. And the observations is that after the last year, and especially since Hurricane Katrina, it's anything but normal. If we just look at the kind of target probability of failures for nuclear facilities, they are at least targeted to be 1 times 10 to the minus 5 per year. However, if we count Three Mile Island, if we count Chernobyl and the three reactors lost at Fukushima, that's 5 major nuclear releases from reactors in 14,000 reactor years. That's 3 times 10 to the minus 4 probability events per year. So clearly, the probability tails are controlling here, and we're not getting those tails correct. Also, we have problems compounded by institutional constraints, politics, lack of perspective, and just plain dysfunction. So The other observation I'd like to make, if I could get this thing to move forward, is the new normal, looking at what we see, is that there is infrastructure which is too big to fail. And it's up to us to decide what it is. So we can define critical infrastructure as often and as much as we want, but my standard for critical infrastructure is that local coalitions. Now, one of the things we know that infrastructure is global in terms of its general characteristics, but it's very local in terms of its personality. Nobody from Los Angeles would tell anybody in New York how to run their infrastructure or vice versa. So local coalitions need to decide what's too big to fail, and they only get one shot at it. That's what critical infrastructure is, because we might be able to do something with respect to that. And as an example of a infrastructure that would be too big to fail is the Southern California water supply. 70% of the water to Southern California, supplying a population of 22 million people, is imported. It comes from the California Aqueduct, the Los Angeles Aqueducts 1 and 2, and the Colorado River Aqueduct. 30% could come from groundwater, but a lot of that's contaminated and won't be used because of environmental constraints. And so if we take a look at the system here, we have institutionally different people responsible for the water going into Southern California. We have the California Department of Water Resources for the California Aqueduct, we have the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power for the LA Aqueducts, and we have the Metropolitan Water District responsible for the Colorado River Aqueduct. So therefore we have a communication issue that has to be resolved for this particular problem. If you were to take a look at the conditions in New Zealand, you might think we have to be worried about Christchurch, but that would be fighting last year's war next year. It's really Wellington. The Wellington Fault cuts Wellington in half. That fault is capable of a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. The recent earthquakes out there did nothing to reduce the seismic hazard on that fault. If that fault were to break, you would decapitate the government. There are tremendous problems with respect to the harbor facilities. The water supply would fail. There would be serious fire hazard there because they have many structures just like those that we see in San Francisco. And then you would also have enormous problems with the electric power system because the cables from the South Island, which produces the energy for New Zealand in hydroelectric power, traverse the Cook Straits and are subject to submarine landslides, and they would cut off the supply of power to Auckland many miles and kilometers away. Okay, so there are some critical infrastructure projects that I've identified here, and then I've taken a look here with respect to this new normal for natural disasters to sort of look at the problem or the issue of punctuated resilience. That is, we need to protect against what is possible beyond what is probable. We need to redefine for ourselves what is critical of infrastructure and take steps to be sure that some things don't fail, particularly those things which are too big to fail. A few smaller issues, and I'll do all these very quickly. In order for us to get there in terms of sustainability and infrastructure, we need leadership. You see a picture here of Mayor Ray Nagin and the now mayor, Mitch Landrieu. Both of those were running for election after Hurricane Katrina. Nagin won. Nagin took off the table because I was with the National Academies, a group for restoring the hurricane protection system in New Orleans. He took off the table from the very beginning that you could abandon portions of New Orleans. And of the 16 members of our committee, we all unanimously agreed that the best solution to New Orleans would be return part of it to the land, to the sea. That is, you have a footprint for New Orleans that's just too big to be sustainable. And so I guess Churchill said that democracy is not the best form of government, but it's the best one that we have. That election initially was won by a person who was supporting not taking an attitude to restoring some of the property to sea. We now have Mitch Landrieu, who has been elected. We'll see what happens. Financing of infrastructure. We have Mayor Christie withdrawing the largest infrastructure project in the United States. And we need to be looking at an infrastructure bank, not only because that supplies private capital that's sorely needed in the public world, but would create an assessment system that's independent of the pork barrel. They would have to create an expert opinion group to evaluate what was important infrastructure to be supported. And then finally, we need to engage engineers in the dialogue. If we take a look at the future of cities, which was convened by the Chatham House, United Kingdom, which is a pre-government, it sets policy, pre-government, pre-policy for government. There were no engineers of 28 speakers. The Economist convened a group to talk about intelligent infrastructure. Less than 10% of the people convened were engineers. And then the Rockefeller Foundation at the Bellagio Center had a series of conversations that have created a very important document called The Century of the City. Of 300 participants, only three were engineers. So clearly, the engineers in this room and elsewhere have an important mission that we have to get outreach to our public leadership. We have to be part of this process of communication, and we need to support the kind of financing that's necessary for infrastructure. Thanks very much.